So we can imagine a long-haul flight. When was the last time you've been on a long-haul flight? You know, the ones you really complain about? How long do they go for? 22 hours, maybe, to get into Europe, to get to London or something? Oh, it's terrible. All right, now I want you to multiply that by days. So instead of, say, 22 hours, 28 days. Imagine that. That is how long it took the first ever successfully completed international flight. It was a flight from London to Darwin. And it happened back in 1919. So tomorrow is the 95th anniversary of this flight. Nowadays, that's 18 hours. So 28 days. Wow. And a person who knows all about this quite extraordinary story is Judy Boland, who's the president of the Fanny Bay Heritage Society in Darwin. And she's been good enough to join me now. Judy, thank you very much for joining us. How did this flight happen?
Thank you very much, Waleed. It happened because the Prime Minister of Darwin at the time was Billy Hughes, and he was a visionary, and he saw that aviation was going to be the future, and more importantly, he saw that that was going to accelerate the development of Australia and link the isolated outposts of Darwin, Perth, Brisbane, Adelaide with the, the economic hub, Melbourne, Sydney, Canberra.
Right, so we have an Australian Prime Minister effectively providing the impetus for this sort of innovation.
Yes, and what's more, he stumped up a prize of £10,000, which in today's money is about $2.5 million. So I wonder whether or not we could do that today. I somehow don't think we would.
Oh, there'd have to be a co-payment of some sort, I imagine.
Perhaps $7.
Now, they did. That's everybody. The details of this flight are astonishing. Take us through it all, the pilots, the crew, the equipment, all that stuff.
Well, conditions of the flight were that the plane had to be British made and the crew had to be British or Australian. And I think there were probably, I can't remember, 10 or a dozen crews started out, but Ross and Keith Smith and their two mechanics were the first to finish. One fellow came in, I think, about 9 months later. Now, what you've got to realise, of course, is that there were no facilities as we know them today, and of course if they needed a spare part, if the mechanics couldn't manufacture it from whatever, it would have to be sent by ship from England out to wherever the plane was stranded. And there's a wonderful story of Wally Shires, one of the mechanics with Ross and Keith Smith, where their petrol pump sprung a leak. So he had a consignment of Wrigley's chewing gum that had been provided for the crew, to ease the tension of a long trip. And he got all this, he got his crew chewing like mad, got sufficient gum, and he used that to patch up the petrol pump and then bound it up with rags, chewed furiously. Then when it was soft, put it on the petrol pump and bound it with rags, and that's the way they limped along.
That's brilliant. That's how you do it on a budget.
That's how you do it.
Yeah.
Yes. And then on another occasion, they were so heavily laden with fuel that the plane, with all the crew on board, the plane wouldn't take off. So they put the tallest fellow out, who was Jim Bennett, and he actually ran alongside the tail of the plane. And then once the wheels got off the ground and began to get airborne, he leapt aboard like you'd do a horse, but he had a rope around him, so that if he slipped and they couldn't hold him, he had to make his way to the next railway station, which I think was Taranto in Italy, and get himself back to London.
That's brilliant. I'm pretty sure that's still how public transport works in Cairo. At least last time I was there, that's how it worked. So what did they do for communications, like radios and
maps? They didn't
maps
have any radios. They basically used a school atlas and navigated from landmarks, so it was visual navigation all the way along the line.
Hang on. Say that again. They used a school atlas.
School atlas, that's right, and it was visual navigation all the way from London to Surabaya in Indonesia, well, modern-day Indonesia. And, of course, the problem was they had 500 miles of water to cross between what's now known as Timor and Australia. So Billy Hughes, again, directed the warship HMAS Sydney to position itself midway between Timor and Darwin, with its bows pointing towards Darwin, to give them a visual clue as to which direction they should be flying.
Did they know that was going to happen? How did they communicate that was what was going to be there?
I think it would have been prearranged with perhaps a message to the governor of the province in Timor.
This is brilliant. I love it.
Absolutely fantastic. We just don't appreciate the comfort and ease that we've got today is due to the intrepid ability of these fellows.
And especially the life jackets, because tell me if I'm wrong, is it true?
The life jackets were going to take up precious space, and they needed every available inch of space and weight allocation for their fuel to get them over this long haul. And so they reckon that the inner tubes of the tyres on the plane would suffice if they went down as a drink. So you can just imagine jumping or bailing out of the plane with an inner tube around them, and off they went.
Everybody grab a tyre.
Everybody grab a tube. And I'm sure that as a child you would have jumped into a river, a dam, or a swimming pool or something on an inner tube of a car tyre.
This is stunning. I think we should go back to it, Judy. I think we're too soft these days.
Well, look, you know, you've got to realise that these fellows, they risked life and limb to basically prove that flight was viable and a safe means of travel. And, you know, we all benefit from that today, from the rapid transport of freight and passengers safely around the world.
That's amazing. It is a great story. Thank you so much for telling it to us, Judy.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Waleed.
Judy Boland, president of the Fanny Bay Heritage Society in Darwin. Wow. Wow, imagine being on that flight.